Welcome to Copyright Clearance's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Friday, March 6th, 2020. Our guest on the show is Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, who joins me every Friday with news and insights on publishing and reading. Welcome back to the show, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So last week, Andrew, we were preparing to head out for the London Book Fair, scheduled to open on Tuesday, March 10th. But on Wednesday this week, fair organizers Reed Exhibitions canceled next week's show over fears of the coronavirus. How is that decision sitting with publishers?
Well, I think the decision to cancel is totally understandable, and it was completely predictable and expected, I would even say. But, you know, personally, it's disappointing, especially for me, because as you well know, for the last 6 weeks, I've been putting together all these features for our show dailies in London. I've got some really great stuff there, including some pieces from you, who is your valued contributor to the PW show dailies. And now I'm not going to be able to distribute them in London. I'll find a place to use them, of course. But, you know, it's a lot of work for me, and I know it's a lot of work for other publishers now. That's just not going to happen. So that's sad. And it's a trip to London in the spring. We all love that. Also going to miss that. But I think the feeling among publishers is that this whole episode was handled pretty badly by the London Book Fair organizers, though I'm not exactly sure they had much choice in how this all went down. You know, last week as we recorded, we had learned that like a number of publishers and like other businesses who had decided not to come to London, right? People were starting to pull out, given the advice of medical professionals and growing concerns about the potential spread of the COVID-19 coronavirus. Well, on Monday of this week, a UK government report was issued on what the government is going to do to combat the virus and with what's happening over there. And that report did not specifically mention shutting down large international gatherings like the London Book Fair. So LBF made the decision to carry on. And that generated a massive backlash. Indeed, the turning point seemed to come after London Book Fair released a statement saying they were going ahead with the show after the government report was issued. You know, all of the big five publishers backed out by Tuesday. Penguin Random House had been sort of hanging on. They were like the last one to say they were still in. But I think the real turning point came when the UK divisions of the large international trade publishers decided that they weren't even going to send their staff across town to go to Olympia. And once you lose the UK staff, well, you don't really have a fair anymore. Now, in fairness, London organizers were following UK government guidelines, and they were working with the advice from public health authorities. And, you know, as of this taping, the UK has still not said, don't get together in these large groups. It has not prohibited these big international gatherings. And so really, that's where the problem lies with the government.
And indeed it does, Andrew, because any such pronouncement possibly triggers insurance coverage for cancellation-related damages.
That's exactly right. Now, Reed Exhibitions, which operates the fair, canceled the show. So it's possible that there's, you know, in fact, likely that there's going to be some refunds or some make goods made up to London Book Fair attendees that, you know, now are not going to the show. But because Reed canceled so late, the shipping costs of getting the booths there and the people to London, and quite a few people had already sent their staffs and their booths had already arrived in London, you still got to pay those costs. You know, it really was kind of a tightrope to walk for London for a while now. And you know, if the government had stepped up as they should have, things might have been different. But they waited, the London Book Fair organizers waited and waited for the government to give them some reason to cancel, which never came. Then all of their attendees gave them a reason to cancel. Basically, if no one is coming, you can't really have a show, right? But I can tell you that I understand why you would wait for the government action, because I'm now personally dealing with a fallout of that. For example, my conference hotel is not refunding my fully paid reservation. My airline is not refunding my flight cost because the government is not forcing the cancellation. This was a choice that was made by Reed. And my travel insurance, I come to realize, hey, it doesn't cover pandemics. Terrorist attack, yes, covers that. Injury, sure, it covers that. But pandemics, nope. Got to deal with it. So I think it's a little absurd that the UK government assembled a task force, put together a group to address the coronavirus pandemic here, and came out and decided not to cancel a large international gathering or not to issue guidance saying, don't come, don't do this. But this is where we are. Anyway, the fair will be back next year. That much we heard from London Book Fair organizers. It's going to be the 50th anniversary of the London Book Fair, so I expect it will be quite a party. And we also learned that the fair is once again going to be in March. So anyone hoping for a return to April is going to be disappointed by that news.
And at the London Book Fair next year, virus or not, the count of big publishers could fall by one. It was revealed this week that Simon & Schuster is officially on the market for sale, which could mean we could have the big four publishers and not the big five.
Yeah, another reason why I'm disappointed not to have a London Book Fair this year. So much news broke this week, and boy, it would be great if we were all together under one roof to get some immediate reaction to all of this. But you're right on that. The big news this week is, you know, something we've been expecting to hear for many years now, and especially been waiting to hear this following the completion of the Viacom-CBS merger. But at a Morgan Stanley investor conference, Viacom CEO Bob Bakish said that Simon & Schuster – one of the big five publishers is not a core asset to the company, and they're going to be fielding offers. So Simon & Schuster on the market. And they're going to get offers, absolutely. You know, as Bakish noted, the company has received interest in the past from companies about buying Simon & Schuster. And the word around the industry is that News Corp, which is the owner, of course, of HarperCollins, is the most logical suitor.
And how does news like that play, do you think, at Simon & Schuster's offices?
Well, I think it probably cuts both ways. You know, on one hand, you have to look at the success of Penguin Random House, and you have to think, you know, if you're a Simon & Schuster, that it would be great to have the size to compete with a house like Penguin Random House. But at the same time, the Penguin Random House merger, as successful as it was, it led to staff cuts, you know, cuts of duplicate positions. There was an office move or two in there too. And, you know, frankly, lots of changes. As reported on the Publishers Weekly site this week, Simon & Schuster CEO Carolyn Reedy sent a March 4th letter to staff breaking the news about Bakish's remarks. Reedy said that, you know, whatever the outcome, the process does not change what we know to be true of Simon & Schuster, that it's a great publishing house, one of the world's best known publishing brands, and it has a great legacy and a bright future. And I think those remarks probably meant a lot to staff there. But that future, as bright as it may be, is very much uncertain right now. In addition to News Corp, the Hachette Book Group parent company, the Lagardère Group, is another company that likes the book business and could be very much interested in acquiring Simon & Schuster. I've even heard some chatter out there that all three of those publishers could team up, that you could see a Hachette, Simon & Schuster, and News Corp deal, which I think is unlikely. But anything is possible. But, you know, Hachette, it should be noted, you know, has had a number of acquisitions recently, including the purchase of 1,200 children's book titles from Disney. Now, all the speculation is that SNS is going to be sold and merged, and it's going to be one of the big five publishers. It doesn't seem likely that a suitor from outside of our current big five book business is going to bite at the opportunity to pick up Simon & Schuster. Could be wrong. That could certainly happen. A company that wants an American publishing footprint might indeed go for this. But I think it's fair to say that come London next year, we're probably going to be looking at the big four. And you know, that's only going to raise more concerns about consolidation in the industry. So you know, stay tuned, because you know, 2020 is shaping up to be quite a year, and I can only imagine what the 2021 London Book Fair is going to look like.
Also this week, Andrew, you finally had a chance to read the terms of the settlement agreement in the Audible Captions lawsuit, which was publicly filed on March 4th. The parties had tried to file the settlement under seal.
Yeah, that's right. This week, attorneys for Audible and the seven plaintiff publishers for the first time publicly shared the final terms of their settlement agreement, which ended the litigation over Audible's captions program. And as you say, the filing comes after the parties were twice rebuffed by Judge Valerie Caproni, who insisted on more public transparency regarding the settlement's final terms. And after Caproni on February 26th gave the parties something of an ultimatum. Basically, she said, either make this deal more transparent or the court won't retain jurisdiction over parts of the deal, which honestly, I don't think was that big a deal. Anyway, in the end, the parties ultimately chose to redact only the amounts that are due to be paid to the seven plaintiff publishers and the Association of American Publishers. Yes, they're getting a cut too, from Audible. These redactions, of course, were expressly approved by Caproni, but the rest of the terms are now open to the public. And that public release of the settlement and other related documents, a couple of letters, for example, arguing why the settlement should be sealed, those are now open to the public. And paves the way for Caproni to sign off on the final restraining order, the final, injunction that restrains Audible from including AAP member works and captions without permission. That, of course, was already public. And it also means that Caproni can retain jurisdiction over the related settlement agreement.
And you've read the papers that were filed, Andrew. Did you find any surprises in the settlement?
Yeah, not really. No, I was pretty disappointed. I thought there would be something a little more interesting in there. But in the end, it's still not clear to me why the parties ever sought to keep the settlement terms private in the first place, other than the fact that, NDAs and confidentiality agreements are pretty much the default for Audible's parent company, Amazon, and the major publishers, and increasingly, frankly, the AAP. The question I have is, why did this take 4 months? I mean, beyond the revelation of the settlement containing payments from Audible to AAP and to the publishers, the settlement is brief. It's just 18 paragraphs. They're all simple. They're all standard. And they're all pretty straightforward. There's a February 6th letter that was initially filed when the settlement was filed with the court that, sort of tries to shed a little light on why the parties wanted the settlement to be filed under seal. It was ultimately rejected by Caproni. But basically what it says is that the parties had this expectation of confidentiality and that it contained confidential settlement terms between Audible and the AAP, which was a non-party. But it doesn't really explain why they really felt like they needed to have these terms kept secret. And I didn't see anything in the terms that really called out for being kept secret. I do think there was one minor surprise in the settlement, and that comes in paragraph 11 of the deal. Now, Judge Caproni had specifically called out paragraph 11 in her February 26 order, saying that she didn't see anything in there that needed to be redacted. Well, basically, paragraph 11 essentially gags the parties. It limits both sides to giving the public only this really rote, short statement. In fact, it was the very statement that AAP gave to Publishers Weekly on February 7th when the deal became public.
And now that you've seen the resolution, is it a total victory?
Well, it's a win for the publishers. I don't think there's any question about that. They've stopped the captions program, but I'm still left with so many questions about this case. And I'll just point out that it ended exactly the way I said it would. I always knew it was going to go this way from the beginning, and that's with Amazon sort of finding an exit. And they were able to do so because the program never launched. And frankly, it was never even slated for a public launch. So here's what we know. Audible paid something to the publishers and the AAP. Big deal, because money is not a big problem for Audible. We don't know how much they paid, so let's take that with a grain of salt. We also know that Audible has concluded, or at least publicly acknowledged, that it needs permission if it wants to bring copyrighted works into the program. And that's, of course, if it ever does expand the program, which I'm betting they're not going to do. One thing that has become clear throughout this hearing is that the Audible Captions program, the AI that scrolls the few words of text when the Audible audiobook plays, well, that's not ready for prime time. The program just isn't very good yet. But also, I think a big deal here is that copyright was unscathed here. And I think that's great. There was no fair use ruling. There was no precedent here. There was no long court battle, nothing. And with, AI just sort of getting started here, I think we avoided a ruling in this realm here that really could have gotten quite messy for future innovation. But rest assured, that day is, I'm almost certain, coming. But at least it gives legislators and policymakers a chance to get out in front of the courts when it comes to AI and copyright. So that's a good thing here, too. Still, I am left with a lingering question, and that's why? Why? What happened here? I also wonder why the publishers came to the table. Last September, the publishers were insistent that the court rule on their preliminary injunction. Well, what changed? Again, I believe that Audible may have lost the motion for preliminary injunction, that they would have been restrained preliminarily by the court, and that would have been a disaster for them. But I also believe that Audible mooted the suit. I believe that, as they said, that, the copyright case here filed, in their opinion, was premature. I think they may have been right, and that case might have been tossed had it been litigated further, but that Audible was going to mothball the project anyway. So I don't know what was going on here. It seems like for some reason Audible was pushing the publishers. They were testing them for some reason. I just don't know what that is. And again, I'll go back to a major point that I made from the beginning. When has Amazon ever launched a product based on fair use? It just makes no sense to me that this is what they would do, that they would take this odd little program and depend upon fair use and try to push it out there with their major partners. It just doesn't make sense to me. In the end, with an Amazon company, everything is a negotiation. So to me, there was zero chance that this was ever going to get to a court ruling. But what was Audible really up to here? Why didn't they just come out with the publishers right away and say, this isn't going to launch right away, but here's what we're thinking? I just don't know. Well, I can say this. The case is now coming to an end, and I'm left with the feeling that this is just one more chapter in a weird, complicated, somewhat dysfunctional relationship between a dominant Amazon and five dominant publishers, soon to be four.
It's a bit of a combination of Survivor and As the Book World Turns, Andrew.
Indeed. Actually, that wouldn't be a bad podcast right there.
I like it too. Andrew Albany, senior writer with Publishers Weekly, thanks for joining me today and every Friday on Beyond the Book.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.